Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello and welcome to episode number 535 of Smart Podcast Trashy Books. I'm Sarah Wendell and my guest today is author Freya Marsk. I did not know that she was longing to be on the show, and I'm so excited to have her on today. Her latest book, A Restless Truth, is out this week. And if you like queer, magical, historical mysteries with murder, you will like this series. We are going to talk about magic having a physical cost and how her favorite magical systems in fiction work, plus magical spells. And we have many, many recommendations, which are a kind of magic all their own, aren't they? So grab your cauldron and join us. Hello and thank you to our Patreon community. Patreon folks get bonus episodes. We have a Discord. It is a lovely, charming, beautiful place. We would love to have you join us. Every pledge keeps me going, keeps the show going, and helps me make sure that every episode has a transcript from Garlic Knitter. Hi, Garlic Knitter. Have a look at patreon.com/smartbitches. We would love to have you join our community. This episode is brought to you by my favorite comfortable, washable shoes, Rothy's. Remember when back to school and the change of seasons meant a whole new wardrobe? When I was a kid, it was because I outgrew my clothes, and now it's just fun to have a few new things, and it may still mean that for you. So why not let Rothy's be your new favorite shoes this fall? Rothy's are comfortable right out of the box, which is one of the things I love about them. I like so many of the styles, I want all of them, and as you might have heard me mention, they're washable. I love this so much. If I'm out for a walk, or I'm cooking, or it's damp out, my shoes get dirty, no worries. I just toss them in the washing machine and they come out looking brand new. I had no idea my favorite thing about my shoes as I got older would be that they're washable and durable and last for a really long time. But here we are, and that's why. Whenever I'm deciding on an outfit, most of the time I start with Rothy's and work my way up. Which ones? Well, it depends. I have the flat, I have the lace-up sneaker, I have four pairs of the point, the loafer, and the moccasin, which I just got in a raspberry pink, and I love it so much. They're so cheerful. I grin whenever I wear them. Rothy's are washable, durable, and so comfortable. All of the things I prefer in pretty much everything, but especially my shoes. Find your new favorite shoes and get ready to be asked, are those Rothy's? Plus, get $20 off your first purchase at rothys.com/Sarah. That's rothys.com/Sarah. Are you ready to discuss magic, murder, mayhem, and all of the recommendations? Let's do this. On with my podcast with Freya Marsk.
I'm Freya Marsk, and I'm a writer of fantasy and romance and romantic fantasy. My debut novel, A Marvelous Light, came out in November last year, and it's a queer historical fantasy which kicks off a queer historical trilogy.
I love a good trilogy. It was one of my favorite things when I was researching this. All of the things you said about building a trilogy, which I will get to. But congratulations on A Restless Truth.
Thank you.
Okay, first of all, I love the covers so much. I love the Edwardian wallpaper. I mean, did they just sort of wake up Morris and be like, listen, we just need you to come back to life for like three covers. You can go back to
Look, I wouldn't put it past the art department. I mean, Will Staley, who did the covers, is incredible. And they were really lovely and said, look, do you have any ideas, any inspiration? And I said, do I?
Oh,
and then very politely sent them an email with about 20 attachment images. Well, here's a few initial thoughts. And I think they sort of went, okay.
Yeah. Oh, clearly we know what we're talking about here.
But I love them. I can't wait to see what they come up with for book three.
What will readers find inside A Restless Truth? I absolutely loved your description of a fantasy of very bad manners.
Yes. Yes. A Marvelous Light being book one was definitely more in the fantasy of manners. I think in A Restless Truth, which is book two, the pretense at manners gets a little bit thinner.
Yeah.
So in terms of what readers will find inside this book, my initial list is a sapphic romance, which is a rake wallflower speedrun. All the fun, grandeur and aesthetic of the Titanic, but zero icebergs.
Good call.
A lot more of the magical world building that we see in book one, live readings of Victorian pornography, and at least one ghost.
That's fabulous. That's actually a really good roundup. I would have. I was trying to describe it to my husband, and I was like, okay, so it's a murder mystery, but with magic and fantasy and lesbians on a cruise ship. So it's the cruise ship version of a locked room mystery with magic.
It is. It's a locked boat.
Yeah, it's a locked boat. And it's actually kind of terrifying. One thing that I love that you did, by the way, is that in about the midpoint, they all kind of meet each other. Like they all know who the enemy is. They know. Yeah, they're like, okay, we know you're on deck two, you're on deck three. Okay, we all know where you are. Just stay out of our way.
I quite like it when a midpoint does change not only something about the relationship status quo, but something about the status quo of the book.
Yeah.
And I quite like the idea that the whodunit aspect becomes a little bit less relevant in the latter half of the book. And it's much more about how do we get this thing back? Who has the MacGuffin?
Yeah.
And it's just hijinks on a boat from that point onwards.
Yes. And because book one and book two fit together in this progression of the larger story, pieces of book one inform book two. But if you haven't read book one, you can kind of figure stuff out in book two, but it's just much richer if you've read book one.
Yeah. And I think I liked that it was a very different type of story. So for people who haven't read it, in book one, we meet Edwin and Robin. We get their relationship, their romance, their introduction into this conspiracy adventure. And book two features Robin's younger sister, Maud, who we meet briefly in book one. And she is absolutely determined to take part in this adventure. And the other narrator is a woman called Violet, who is new. And she's been working as a theatre magician in New York City and is now coming home to England after coming into an unexpected inheritance. And as narrators, they are very different people to Robin and Edwin. And so I knew from the beginning that the tone of book two would also be very different. So I think it feels more like a companion than a sequel.
Yeah.
Because the people that you're seeing, that whose eyes you're seeing the story through, are completely different.
Absolutely. And the world that the characters are operating within, the rules are pretty consistent from book one to book two. So once you figure them out, that part is systematically the same.
Book three starts to dig into those rules and break them apart a little bit.
I love this plan. I'm thrilled to be a part of it. One of the things that I admire so much about this series is that for the characters in the world of magic, magic is a finite resource. It's like the energy you have to do things. It's like your cognitive energy, your physical energy. It's not a limitless resource. You can't just summon it and use it all up. You get tired. There are costs to the magic, which I appreciate very much as one of the rules. What are some of the other costs of magic in this world?
I like that you enjoyed that aspect because that was something I did very deliberately. I agree. I don't like it when magic is too easy and too simple and cost-free. And I really enjoyed writing Edwin, especially as somebody who operates in this world that puts a huge amount of value on how much magic you have, i.e. how much you can use at once or in a day. As somebody who has never had that much and is operating from a place of basically an inferiority complex about how much magic he has and has compensated with the kind of personality he has by coming at it from a very systematic, precise academic perspective. But the idea of what are the costs of magic is a question that I'm addressing a lot more in book three, which I've just finished the first draft of.
Congratulations!
It is off with my editors.
Yay!
Thank you. Oh, yes, it's very nice. I'm in this great
Cheers to that.
Cheers. I'm in great post-book lull at the moment while my editors look at it for me. But book three looks a lot more about this big theme that I wanted to explore, which is a very Spider-Man with power comes responsibility kind of theme.
Yeah.
If power was originally granted as a gift in the understanding that it would be used for something in particular, what are the dangers that come when it is then used for something else? And if magic, which is a finite resource, has been shaped and practiced in a way approved by a certain set of people who set the rules in society, what does that mean about previous knowledge which might have been lost? And I laid some seeds for this in book one. I obviously dig into it a lot more in A Restless Truth with some of the revelations we get about the Forsythia Club, this group of old women who were young women once and who were doing magic not by the rules set by society. And then once I've expanded that scope in book two, we really explode it some more in book three.
And of course, if you're going to set this in Edwardian England, there's a wee bit of class structure, a little bit.
Just a teensy little sort of class.
Just a smidge, yes. Right? Yeah. And the same forces that try to keep you in line. I recently had this theory when I was looking at a lot of the coverage of the Queen's death, actually, that the English are absolutely fucking obsessed with cues. Like just the line. Where are you in the line? Who's in front of you in the line? Who's behind you in the line? Where are you in the line? And don't cut the cue. That's treason. Like you can say all kinds of dastardly, terrible thing, but my God, if you cue jump, the whole country hates you.
Yeah. And book one played a little bit with that.
Yes, it did.
Robin has the highest social status. He's a baronet. And he was thrown into this house full of people who have more money than him and also have more magic than him because he has no magic at all. And therefore they look on his title as it's important. Socially, like it sets some social rules, but they still think of themselves as slightly apart. So it was interesting to play with this idea of a group of people who recognize and exist within this class structure, but also have a level of class of their own.
Yes.
Which sort of shifts how they behave within one another. And book three is all about class and all about the Edwardian era and some of the social shifts that were happening at that time. Like one of the earliest scenes in book three is actually set in Westminster in the Houses of Parliament.
Oh,
and
cool.
The entire romance in book three, which if you have read book two and you have any romance instincts at all, you can probably guess who the central romance in book three is because you don't put an asshole aristocrat with secret angst on the page.
No.
Without promising your reader.
Yes.
That will be book three.
Yes. That gentleman is Lord Sequelbait right there.
Lord Sequelbait, exactly, from the very beginning. And it's been wonderful having fantasy readers come to me and say, I don't know why, but I know he wasn't on the page very much. And like, I know he was pretty horrible, but I don't know. I found that character really compelling. And I'm like, that's because you're recognizing romance Sequelbait.
That's right.
In a fantasy novel.
That's right. He really is Lord Sequelbait all over the place.
Yes. So as you may imagine, Lord Sequelbait's book has a lot to do with class and class inequality and how you negotiate a relationship where there is a huge power disparity and some very mixed feelings about that power disparity on both sides.
Yes, very much so. Especially because he has a lot of feelings about them that he doesn't want to talk about because feelings are annoying and he would really rather not.
Of course.
I mean,
he was the kind of person where and this ties into a little bit about how I structured the trilogy, but I couldn't actually drag him from, he couldn't be the same person at the beginning of his own book as he was in book one.
Yeah.
There was too much to travel, too far to travel. So I had to do some of his emotional work on page in book two.
Oh, yeah.
To drag him a little bit closer towards those emotions.
Yes.
That he was so reluctant to recognize. And so by the time we hit the ground running in book three, he has already done some of his emotional arc, and I've already done the first two, three beats of his romance in book three.
Nice.
In book two.
And, you know, here in Romance Land, we are very familiar with the character who's truly dastardly in book one, becoming book three, and suddenly we cannot get enough of this person that we all hated two books ago.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
We're all
so
big fans of that.
So if I've done that, I've done the job right.
Well done. Yes. I'm a big fan of Lord Sequelbait, who has to have a big emotional redemption and figure out how to have feelings. They're so annoying. Now, I read an interview at the LA Public Library website that this trilogy was inspired by the trilogy structure of romance novels, which we've talked a lot about. And I'm so excited about this because you have the ensemble cast, you have a fantasy plot, but then each book is the love story of a different couple, which I personally love because the more people you can hang out with in a world, the more fun it is. Like, I love fanfic that's like, okay, these people are all real cool. Let's talk about this random person who is in like one quarter of a scene. We're going to just imagine their whole world. I'm like, yes, bring it to me. Send them to the coffee shop.
Yep.
We're going to go to IKEA together. I want to read all of this. I'm all about it. I love this so much. How have you liked writing within this structure? And what has feedback from readers been like who are more accustomed to fantasy structures?
Yeah, I have loved writing it this way because I think it really appeals to the kind of stories that I want to write. And look, I have enormous respect for people in both spheres, romance and fantasy, who can pull off a multiple book series with the same characters, and especially in romance. So look, I think KJ Charles's Will Darling Adventures is my most often quoted example of this done phenomenally well. But I always knew I was building essentially a queer found family leverage heist crew. Like that's where we're at by book three, really.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to build that crew across the three books. And look, I'm a sucker for the falling in love romance process. So this way I get to tell three love stories and give the reader all the stuff that we love about this when we see it in romance novels, which is we get to dangle the sequel bait in the first couple of books.
Yep.
And we also get to give the reader, especially in book three, a lot of on-page time with the previous couples. So you can see them when they're together and being a bit more couple-y rather than going through all of the ups and downs and angst of the getting together process.
Yes.
So for me, like, it was an absolute joy to write it this way. And it was a little bit of a gamble because you're right, fantasy, I think, is less used to that kind of thing. And there are a lot of people who are fairly disappointed. You know, they got really attached to Robin and Edwin in book one. And like, oh, okay, so I guess we'll spend some time with somebody else. And you actually see a great deal of Robin and Edwin in book two. And that, again, was a bit of a risk that I took.
Yeah.
Like, I made sure I put them in a little bit.
They are there.
But hopefully they're there. But a lot of the there is in the negative space and in the way that they're thought about and referred to. But they are there on the page as well. But hopefully by book three, all will be forgiven because book three brings in everybody.
Yep.
From the previous two books, which was a headache at the beginning because I was very used to juggling only two people. So yeah. Robin and Edwin's book is very you and me against the world, you know, forced proximity, quest romance.
Yeah.
Book two is a bit bigger. Like, we still have the two central people, but then we have some strong supporting characters and we're starting to get the sense of a crew being built.
Yeah.
And book three, I had to juggle seven primary characters who are involved in this, a whole lot more secondary characters. Ooh. And but we're still only having two narrators,
right?
So there's a lot of who narrates this scene, why is this person in this scene, but also getting to do the really fun thing that you do with leverage, which is break the group off into little twos and threes,
yes,
with people who maybe haven't interacted much before and get to really just swim around in the delicious dynamics of having an ensemble cast.
Yes. That's one of my favorite things about video games. When you have all of the characters and then you go on a quest in some large multiplayer games and in some open world games, you have to pick the players that are going to go with you on a specific quest. You can't bring everybody. You got to bring three. So you might want to have a warrior or a mage or a rogue or somebody who can like do cool things with swords. Like, you have to figure out, wait, where am I going and who am I bringing? But my favorite part is taking the long way around to wherever it is I'm trying to go so I can hear all of the dialogue between the characters that's been built in. That's the best part, right? When you put these people into little combinations, you're like, oh, you're going to bring out this side of this person. And like, you two are going to start to flirt. This is great. Let's walk all the way around the forest before we go inside because I want to hear all your dialogue. Like, that's really fun because it's a way of adding to the characters by having them interact with each other in different subsets.
I'm so glad you said that because I have a tendency to start with the characters and then work backwards the plot.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm coming from a romance side of things. And so a lot of planning of book three was, what side quest can I give this group of people or this duo of people that ties into both of their skills, so makes it obvious that these are the logical people to be going on this side quest.
Yes.
But also means I can then get them to have a conversation about feelings.
Yes, absolutely. And the more dialogue that you use to do that, the more the characters get to speak for themselves, which I always love as a reader. I am awful, terribly awful, about skimming long paragraphs of exposition. I just want to hear people talking to each other. I am a shameless eavesdropper, whether it's texts or podcasts. I just want to listen to the characters talking to each other. So the amount of talking and arguing is just, it's top shelf.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to you reading book three.
You can send it to me. I mean, if you just want to start reading, you know, chapter one, that's fine. I mean, I've got time. Bedtime's not for another hour and a half.
All right. I'll consider it. It is still in first draft form.
It's going to change. It'll change a little bit.
But I think is probably the first draft is the one that is the closest to like my ideal self-indulgent vision for the book, which means there's probably a lot of just, what if we all just sat around a table and talked?
Yes.
Which I'm pretty sure my editors will come back and be like, Freya, they have sat around a table and talked for three scenes in a row. Please give them something to do.
I recently read a book called The Monsters We Defy by Leslie Penelope. And it is a 1920s magical heist set in Washington, D.C. in the Black business community of, I think it was Northwest D.C. And it's fabulous. But the characters are all coming from different parts of the community. And they all have different magical affinities and abilities. And they're realizing that people are disappearing. And there's a lot of time where they all sit around a table and they talk. And they go to a lot of speakeasies. And I'm like, listen, I do not care if you ever get to the big bad, just keep talking. So this is why I'm not an editor.
It is a real part of the heist genre that we don't think about so much.
Yeah.
Because you have a group of people planning a heist. And like the Ocean's 11 films do this so well, is that you can put two people in a ridiculous situation. They are there to prep some ridiculous side aspect of the heist. Who cares? Yeah. We don't care. And they just have a ridiculous conversation. And so the joy of those films is often in the conversations that people are having when you have just planted them in plot location B.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, yes, keep going, keep talking. Get another round.
Keep talking.
Yeah, get another round. More beers, mm-hmm. More beers.
Keep talking. Yep.
So where did the idea of cradling to learn and then cast magic originate? Was this from like string finger games when you were a kid? Because every time I pictured cradling, I was like, oh, like you mean like the witch's broom with the string, and then I would make a shape?
Yeah,
then,
essentially.
Like, yeah,
They refer to it in book one. Robin refers to it as scratch cradle, which is the old word for, that was like around before they called it cat's cradle.
Yeah.
It was called scratch cradle or cat's cradle. And a lot of, when it was first done, it was something that you did in pairs. Like one person did a design, somebody else did it like that.
Stuck your hand through the bottom, yeah.
Yeah, and then it developed into string tricks, like the witch's broom and things like that. And I had a book of string tricks, like the cat's cradle, that you can do by yourself when I was a kid. And I just worked my way through it and learned to do them all. And so that was a very, it was always just sitting in the back of my mind as something you can do with string.
Yeah.
But the idea of cradling as a magical system is something that I stole from myself from a short story that I had written, where the magic system was very beside the point. It was a very sort of epistolary romance kind of short story, but I needed a new magical system. And so I found myself just writing the word cradle for like a system of gesture, because I was thinking like something to do with gesture magic. And then I was like, oh, like cat's cradle. Oh, cradle. Okay, cool. Yeah. And I just used it for that. The story hasn't been published and I just sort of left it there. But the idea of that as a magic system stuck with me. And so when I was writing A Marvelous Light, I knew I wanted to build on that. And it became quite good because of what I wanted to do with Edwin as someone who didn't have much power.
Yeah.
The idea that you would learn to do magic with almost training wheels.
Yeah.
And then the string would be how you learn to hold your hands in the correct position. But then once you had learned the spell, you weren't expected to use the string anymore. You were expected to just move much faster, almost like speaking a language, not enunciating all of the words in the sentence with perfect grammar.
Absolutely.
You know, a native speaker would just sort of flow the words together and drop particular parts of words. But because Edwin doesn't have much magic, he has to be incredibly precise for his meaning to come across to the magic that he's trying to do.
Absolutely.
And so he still uses the string, and it is looked upon as something that only children or very weak magicians would do.
And it works as the dual meaning of cradle, because that is the bassinet or the cradle of their magical training, is from that once using the string is the creche of their magical abilities. And they're supposed to grow out of it, like you said, but they don't. But the foundation is always still there.
But it's so limiting as well. Yeah. Like it's there, like this is how you learn magic. British magicians use string and they do cradles. And only in book two, in A Restless Truth, do I start to show you that maybe other places don't do it that way, that maybe there used to be potential for, even in Britain, for magic to be done in different ways.
Yeah.
But it was just decided that this is the way it's going to be now. It's going to be very contractual, very precise. And then once you start only using one system, then the way you think about magic becomes quite blinkered, I suppose.
Yes, like, it's a very rigid structure. It's the same.
Yeah.
We will do the magic with this shape, and that is the only shape.
Because all you can see is the way that you've been taught.
Yes, exactly. And if we've always done it that way, then that's the way we always have to do it, which is like the worst thing you can say to me. Oh, we do it this way because we've done it that way. And I'm like, okay, but why? That doesn't actually answer my question. And I say a lot, you know, tradition can be very comforting. It can connect you to a heritage. Tradition can connect you to people who are no longer with you. Tradition can also be peer pressure from the dead. And they don't know everything because they're dead. You don't have to listen. It's very particular what you decide to carry forward. And what I love about the cradling aspect of these books is that for Edwin, for example, the cradling is a source of enormous comfort, and it is a way for him to channel as much of the limited power as he has into what he does. And for some of the women in A Restless Truth, the cradling is something that they don't even have access to. They're not allowed to learn that. That's not for women. Women aren't supposed to have that. You're supposed to go have babies and grow a garden and walk around. That's all. That's fine.
And learn some of the magic, but only the kind of magic we think you should have.
Yes, yes. Just the homey stuff. That's fine. Soup magic.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to do, like, I didn't want A Restless Truth. I didn't want my characters to be the ones who are like, we are the special ones who are reinventing magic and looking for new systems. I wanted to show that the people who were doing the reinvention had been around for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, that you have this previous generation of people who became frustrated with the limitations placed on them and said, fuck it, we're doing it ourselves.
Yeah, we'll do it our way.
And so by the time you hit our generation, that knowledge has been quite deliberately hidden, suppressed, kept secret. And so even though my characters might think of themselves as being breaking the mold and looking into new ways of doing it,
yeah,
they're not actually. They have to stumble across this that was done by old women or dead old women and go, oh, actually there is more to what was done than we have seen. Edwin, in and of himself, is not a revolutionary person. It is not in his makeup. Like, he would have just kept doing string forever.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it's also very comforting. Once you know a methodology that works for you, it's very comforting to hold on to it. So what are some of your favorite worlds with magic in them?
Oh, I had to think for a long time about how to cut this one down. I think I grew up reading Terry Pratchett's Discworld from the time I was in my early teens. And what I love about the magic in that world is that the magic is stories.
Yes.
All across the board, no matter what type of magic it is, on one level, magic is story and magic is narrative. And it's about the ways in which we tell ourselves stories about reality shaping reality.
Yeah.
And that's true of the wizards. It's true of the witches. It's true of all the weird sort of one book magical events that come up. It is always about human belief and human story turning reality into something else, which I love. And I think for a storyteller as masterful as Pratchett was, it's the perfect way of using magic in books.
Yeah.
I must admit, I really love Naomi Novik's Scholomance series. And again, I think it's because the cost and the rules and the academic geekery around magic are so clear. You know, I think a lot of people said of the first book, it was just the narrator telling you stuff about her studies for 300 pages. And I was like, I could have done 600 pages. Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed that. I loved a magical world that was both dangerous and about learning and the cost of learning. And,
yeah,
you know, that was just a very, very satisfying world to live in. I'm really looking forward to the third book, which I picked up this week.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I'm going to save my third one, Lois McMaster Bujold's World of the Five Gods.
Oh my goodness.
Which is where the Penric and Desdemona books are set.
Yes.
And I think I actually picked up the first Penric book after your episode.
Really?
On them. Yeah. Because I'd read a lot of Bujold's space opera books, mm-hmm. but never read any of her fantasy. And I was like, oh, okay, well, these are novellas. I'll see how it goes. And then I blinked and fell over and resurfaced a fortnight later with all of the novellas.
Yes. They were my comfort reading. They were some of my comfort reading for 2020 and 2021. Mm-hmm. I went very much into Penric world.
The special edition from Subterranean Press of the first full-length novel. And that is sitting on my shelf as a very break glass in case of emergency, having a terrible day, just need something I know I'm going to love book.
Oh, it's so good.
They're so good. And what I love about the magic in that world is that the intersection between magic and faith is pretty much where that particular world is. So it's not magic and story, it's magic and faith. And so even for the early novels set in that series before we meet Penric and Desdemona, the novels set in that world, it is always about faith and it's always about the idea of gods as a source of magic and faith as a source of magic. But again, it's rules based and it's not just you ask your god for permission to blow up the world and maybe depends on the god, depends on you. Like, it's all quite rooted in personal relationships.
Yes.
And that's what makes the magic really fun and interesting, I think.
And the idea that Penric doesn't have magic except because of this demon that is living in his body. And he's got all of these other, he's got like 13 other echoes of people. And he knows that someday the demon will move on and he will be one of the echoes. And he sort of knows that his magic is a finite time and that there's a finite resource. Like, Desdemona gets tired.
Yeah. And because she's a demon, it has to be in some way not, like, quotation marks, evil, but it has to be a destructive kind of magic, even when he's doing good. Like, I think there's one of the novellas where he essentially gives someone radiotherapy for breast cancer.
Yes.
By seeing where the tumor is and then being destructive towards it, like channeling demon destructive magic very targeted towards the tumor.
Yes.
Which I thought was such a wonderful way of showing that doesn't really matter what type of magic is. What matters is the intentions of the caster and the personality of the caster.
Yes. And when Penric is restoring the eyesight for someone, it's so much uphill magic that he has to go out. He's completely giddy. Yeah. He's out of his mind giddy and he has to go out and like cause some chaos somewhere, which is not his. That's the thing I love about Penric and Desdemona. He's not actually an agent of chaos on his own, but he now has an agent of chaos in his body. And he's kind of like, guess I'm a chaos person now.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's about magic and faith, but it's also about personal relationships and balance. And the idea that you have to balance your uphill magic with your downhill, of course, is a great big metaphor for what it's like to exist with someone and share a life with someone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is what he's doing with Desdemona.
Yes. Why does magic appeal to you as a writer and a reader? I personally love magic stories. I love the Ben Aronovich Peter Grant series so much. I can't reread all of them. Sometimes there's Death of Young Children and I'm like, oh, gonna skip that chapter. But I love them because there's the very familiar trope of a character who knows nothing about this world coming into the world and realizing that they have some affinity within it. But also there's politics and there's, you know, structure and bureaucracy. Maybe my thing is just magical bureaucracy.
There is something to be said for magical bureaucracy.
I think that's my jam.
I think it's because it makes it feel grounded.
Yes, like absolutely.
Like, you're like, no matter how much power this person has, they still have to fill out a fucking form in order to do something.
Yes. God, I have to wait in line at the magical bureaucracy store. God. Mm-hmm. It's like going to the DMV. Oh, fine. I'll renew my license.
But it's also because I think any genre can be made better with magic in it. That's just my opinion. Like,
oh,
I like
romance. Agree.
I like it that you add some magic. The Rivers of London series is what happens when you have a police procedural and you add some magic to it. Yeah, it just infinitely improves it, honestly.
Absolutely.
I think for me, when I was younger, magic was just a thing that was in books because of the kind of books that I was reading. So my earliest memories of books that I read myself were things like Roald Dahl, Enid Blyton, E. Nesbitt, the Narnia books, that sort of classic English children's fantasy books. But that was what I read. So from my perspective, you read books, they had magic in them. That was just what a book was. It was something about people having adventures, usually children having adventures. And there was something fantastical or marvelous or magical about the adventure they were having. And so I then obviously romped off into adult fantasy very quickly in my teens. There wasn't as much YA as a genre as there is now. Certainly there wasn't a great deal of YA fantasy. I think Tamora Pierce books were around, not a great deal else. No. For me, in my head, YA was all like contemporary books about teenagers facing tough issues. And I didn't really care. I just wanted some more dragons. So I sort of leapt from childhood dragons to adult dragons quite quickly. And I always knew if I wanted to write something, I wanted to write fantasy. Because, again, like I just loved the sense of freedom, the sense that you could add more to whatever kind of story you wanted to tell. And so when I got into romance in my 20s, so I was quite a latecomer to romance, because I think of that sort of inter-genre snobbery that exists between science fiction and fantasy and romance, I had just a small amount of internalized misogyny going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I've
seen it. It took me a long time to get into romance, despite the fact that I had been reading and writing fan fiction for a long time. And all of that, like the vast majority of what I was reading and writing for fanfic was romance.
Yeah.
Straight down the line.
Absolutely.
And so when I made the hop into genre romance, I was like, oh, here we go. This is where all the good stuff has been hiding. and then realized I could bring the magic along with me, which was a wonderful feeling.
Oh, yeah. In addition to magical bureaucracy, I think the addition of dragons is an excellent addition to any genre. Bad dragons, instant upgrade, no question.
Yep. Have you read Joe Walton's Tooth and Claw?
Tooth and Claw? Oh, my gosh. Yes.
I remember reading that and be like, what is happening? Like my brain exploded. I was like, I think I'm reading a Jane Austen novel.
This is Regency Dragons.
Regency Dragons? I love, obviously, the traditional dragons of, you know, they're dragon riders and they're destructive and they're dangerous. But also there's something to be said for dragons who are just worried about their marriage prospects.
Yes, absolutely. Dragons can be very worried about the economy and other things. My secondary fandom, in addition to romance, is the How to Train Your Dragon franchise. And the thing about the second movie is that when you get to the second movie, Hiccup and Astrid are already in a relationship. So they skipped all of the courtship stuff and they're already like 5 years into a relationship. So it was like, wow, you're just leaving all this time of romance and courtship for fanfic to fill in?
Yes. Thank you.
It's only 5 million words of fanfic now. Yes.
Well, I think as somebody coming from fan writing, I probably leave a lot less space for fan writers. Oh, yeah. As much as I love fandom and, you know, really hope that I do inspire fan art and fanfic, I am putting a lot more of the stuff on the page that would normally be left off the page for fanfic writers to do themselves.
Yeah.
And that's just because that's what I'm used to. I'm like, well, you know, I want the book that gives me the action and then the feelings and then the sex scene. And so here you go. You can have all of it.
Yes. I need the action. I need the sex scene. I need the quest. I need everyone to sit around a table having drinks. I need all of that in the book. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And that's why I think that like there aren't a lot of fanfics, as far as I know, that really like fandoms that really spring up around romance, because the stuff is there already.
Yeah.
Like there's huge fandoms that grow up around TV shows that are science fiction or fantasy, whatever, that will then fill in all the romance stuff, like the episode coda where everyone sits around, talks about their feelings and goes off and fucks in their bunk on the spaceship, you know?
Right.
That's what the fanfic is there for. But I think in romance, we are emotionally fulfilled at the end of the book. And maybe we do want some more of that particular couple. And sure, we might go off and write our own little coda, but there's not that itching yearning for the feelings bits.
No, the feeling
bits. That other types of media can leave you with.
Yes, the feeling bits have been served in heaping portions. Thank you.
They have been served. They have been sated.
Oh, yes. So if you could have control over three magical spells, which ones would you want? I figured this was a fair question to ask somebody who's writing an entire magical world with lots of different spells
in your books.
I particularly like the one about keeping warm, the winter coat that's spelled to keep warm. I would really like one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I must admit, being able to put spells in clothing would be quite handy. I'm going to cheat and say, like any writer, the one that I would want is one that I didn't actually put in my book, which is the ability to stop time.
Oh, yes.
Just think of how many books you could read slash write slash how clean the house would be if you could pause time. But that is a step too much for the magic in my books.
Yeah.
Like, you can't actually do that.
That's a lot of people.
But any magical spell, that would be it. I think if I could have one of the ones that were in my books, like, I would really like a magical house. I love magical houses so much. I put magical houses in book one. There are more magical houses in book three.
Oh, good. I love
the
magical
idea
house in book
of
one.
A house that the longer you live in it, the more it grows around you.
Yes.
And your personality and your needs and wants. And so you'll just sort of sit down at the end of a long day and the house is like, maybe you need a drink.
Yeah.
I think it's this urge that we see that technology is starting to drift in that direction with the idea of like a Google Home and, you know, all of these smart apps that come with this terrifying tech dystopia baggage of lack of privacy and hackability. And the idea of a magical house is one that can't be hacked. Yeah. It can't be, you know, turned against you because the magic is about the bond with you. So it's somewhere in the realm of like horse books and dragon books of having a magical being that is bonded to you, that you look after and it looks after you, with the added benefit of you can sit down and somebody brings you a hot drink.
Yes. And I would also like that if there are magical houses, the house will just be like, listen, there's a little leak on the side here. I got a little leak. If you take care of it now, it won't be a big leak, but I just want to let you know in the wall over here is a leak. Like a magical house could tell me what's wrong.
Yeah. I think that's why that's very popular science fiction where the ship is itself a character.
Yes.
Because it's the idea of like nurturing shelter and a two-way caretaking relationship.
Yes. That you live, I can't touch you. I don't have hands, but I do have walls and I need you to help me take care of my,
there's a little sensor that says there's a leak on the side.
Beep,
go fix
beep,
it.
Beep. Yeah, please. Do you have a termite? Tell me about this termite. I want to fix this termite for you.
Beep, beep, beep. Yeah. Exactly. That'd be so handy.
Oh my God. So you have stop time.
Having a magical house.
Having a magical house.
And again, with the books, I like Violet's visual illusions, I think would be so much fun.
Oh, for sure.
Like the fact that she has that as her specialty was something that I, as soon as I knew she was a theater, she's a theater kid, basically.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
like the original chaotic bisexual theater kid.
Yes.
And
complete
as soon as
disaster.
I knew she was in the theater, I was like, right, well, what kind of magic would be useful if you're a theatrical kind of person? And of course, it's illusions, being able to create visual effects.
Yep.
So that was really fun to play with in A Restless Truth. And I think that would be a lot of fun, especially if you're somebody who likes creativity. And like, I haven't got a great deal of artistic talent, but I am a very visual writer. Like I very much visualize scenes when I'm reading and when I'm writing, and the ability to create a scene with magic and look at how it plays out. Just think how useful it would be for the blocking of sex scenes.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Oh, here we go. No Barbie dolls needed. Yeah.
Nope. I know exactly where all the arms are. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So I noticed from your Twitter feed that you have started watching A League of Their Own, which I just did a podcast episode on, and I was wondering how you are liking it.
Yes. My Twitter feed suggests I have started A League of Their Own.
So have
my
you
Twitter
actually?
Feed is a little behind.
So you finished
I have
it and started
finished
it over.
A League
again.
Of Our Own.
Yes.
I finished it. I watched it in about a day and a half.
Yep. Yeah, me too.
Yep. Yep. Just sat down and zoomed. We had an unexpected public holiday because of the Queen's death.
Yep.
So we had this public holiday foisted upon us, which was very inconvenient in many ways, but it did mean I had an entire free day in which to sit down and watch about a show about gay baseball, which
hey.
Was wonderful.
I mean, isn't that what the Queen would have wanted? Some gay baseball.
I like to think so.
I think so. Absolutely.
Oh, look, I adored it. I laughed. I nearly cried. Like the sheer variety of queer experience and like the focus on finding community and history when you thought you were alone.
Yes.
Was just like every scene where somebody walks into a place and has their eyes just light up with stunned recognition that a community and a history exists.
Yeah.
That they are not on their own. They're not reinventing this or inventing it in isolation.
No.
It is something that other people have done and have gone through and are there to welcome you. It was just absolutely amazing. Everything about that. So yeah, very, very touching, but also just a hilarious show. Like I loved the found family of the team. I loved Darcy Carden in some of those outfits. My goodness, just there's a lot happening on that screen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, very much.
Yep.
So what books are you reading that you want to tell people about?
How many am I allowed?
As many as you want. It's the internet. We haven't run out of room yet.
I have a few that are out now, and I've got a few that I've read in ARC form.
Brilliant.
That are coming out that I can sort of tease you with. I will speak mostly in the romance sphere. So I really, really love Charlie Adhara's Wolf at the Door paranormal series.
Ooh.
And which is the 5-book series, another one that does this following the same couple across a series incredibly well. Like each book, the mystery is really interesting. Like the plot is fascinating. It's always thrilling, but it also advances the relationship in a really meaningful way. So you always feel that you're ending on a happy for now. And like if the book series didn't continue any further, you'd still feel really comfortable that this couple is going to be together forever.
Yep.
But each time you get a little bit more in a really wonderful way.
Yeah.
And recently the first book in the spin-off series, which is starting a new romance called, so it's called Pack of Lies. Romantic suspense. It's a snowed-in murder mystery. It's very hot. So that came out, arrived on my Kindle. I read it immediately. I said, like, Charlie Adhara is one of my like order in advance and read the night it arrives authors. So I loved that. Highly recommend. I also recently read Sarah McLean's Heartbreaker because I love Sarah McLean's historicals. And this one also just hit a lot of buttons for me. It's a road trip. It's a thief and a lord, which you now having an idea about what book three's romance is going to be, you'll understand that I really love a thief and a lord.
Yep.
As the basis for a romance. And read a while ago, but I have been shoving this book at everybody I can. Akweke Emezi's You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty.
Yes.
Which I think has sort of flown a little under the radar for romance land yet, because it is being sold, because Akweke Emezi writes across genres and is sold as in a very literary space.
Yeah.
But this is a romance. Like it is a straight capital R romance. It is technically about falling in lust and then love with your boyfriend's dad. So it's kind of in that area of romance, but is actually one of the most sensual, detail-oriented books I have ever read. It's about food, like the love interest is a chef, so there's so much food porn, about making art because the main character is an artist. It's about recognition that happens through art and shared grief,
yeah,
and daring to accept something that just rocks your foundations. It is an incredible book. Everyone should read it.
That's
and I think if you're into romance, it is a very, very satisfying romance.
Awesome.
So and I'm trying to think about, okay, 2 ARCs that I've read of stuff that's coming out. Aliette de Bedard's The Red Scholar's Wake. So this is a space opera featuring a marriage of convenience between a captive engineer and a pirate queen who is also a spaceship.
Oh, as you and, do? Yeah.
Okay. As you do. So Aliette de Bedard is incredibly good at sapphic romances where one of them is maybe a spaceship or a dragon or something like that. And this has got really good space opera politics plot, but also a really lovely tropey but sort of slow and mature romance in it. That's coming out, I think, sometime early next year. I can't tell you the exact date, but definitely keep an eye out for it. And the cover is just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I also just finished a book that is coming out from Mills and Boone next year called One Night in Hartswood by Emma Denny. Now, this is wall-to-wall trope deployment. So it is technically about a medieval nobleman who goes into the forest to find the runaway noble who was meant to marry his sister but disappeared on the day of the wedding.
Oops.
And, of course, he finds a mysterious runaway servant in the woods. And both of them are lying about who they are. So we have 2 layers of secret identity. And we have a road trip. We have so much huddling for warmth. We have sexy dagger fighting lessons. But it's about basically shedding your old self in order to find the freedom to be your true self.
Yeah.
And it's just a lovely romance that's got some of those great old-fashioned tropes about, you know, terrible fathers and medieval castles and arranged marriages that you run away from and terrible wounds and thinking the other person's dead. Like, it starts off really slow and comforting, and then it just rockets off into these amazing plot places. So I was really surprised by that. It just sort of was offered to me as an arc, and I said, oh, this sounds fun, and I just devoured it. It was so much fun.
Where can people find you if they wish to find you? If you wish to be found. Some people don't want to be found.
If I wish to be found.
If you want to be
largely found. On Twitter. I think Twitter is where I mostly hang out author-wise. Partially Instagram. I have an Instagram so I can keep track of people taking beautiful photos of my book. Very occasionally, I will post a picture of myself ice skating on it because I'm a figure skater. But
I didn't know that. How cool.
Yeah, that's my secret hobby. It's not really a secret.
That's awesome.
And yeah, well, this isn't really a secret, but I have actually written a couple of contemporary romance novels about figure skaters, which we are attempting to go on submission with, which is fun.
But it's spring for you, so you're just coming out of winter, right?
Yes, it's a little odd. The ice skating season, such as it is, starts about now.
Oh.
And goes through to March.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
International winter.
Winter.
So it means that I am watching ice skating, like lying on my couch under the air conditioning, fanning myself, being like, that looks nice. Yay.
Can I just lie down on the ice? You can jump over me. It's fine.
Yeah. And so going to the ice rink in summer in Australia is lovely because you step in. Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Room full of ice.
Let's Wonderful. Do it.
And I still go to the rink during winter, but there's no ice skating on during Australian winter because
It's summer here. Yep. That makes sense.
Anyway, I got a little sidetracked. Yes, largely Twitter, partially Instagram. Both of those are just at Freya Mask. And my website is freyamask.com.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you to Freya for getting up early to talk to me from Australia. And thank you to her publicist, Caro Perney, for setting this up. I will have links to all of the books we talked about and her two books in this series, A Restless Truth and A Marvelous Light, in the show notes at smartpitchestrashybooks.com/podcast. As always, I end with a really bad joke, and this one is perfect for right now. Are you ready? This one comes from my husband, Adam. Why is voter turnout so high in Transylvania? Give up. Why is voter turnout so high in Transylvania? Because every count votes. One vote. Two. That joke makes me very happy. And if you are able to, I hope you are voting. On behalf of everyone here, we wish you the very best of reading. Have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you back here next week. Smart Podcast, Trashy Books, is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more outstanding podcasts to subscribe to at frolic.media/podcasts. Vote! Ha, ha, ha.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.